From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. On today's show, the Bay Area pursues alternatives to gasoline, melding high tech and biology. Termites may be a big part of the formula.
We went to Costa Rica. We found a nest of termites. We then dissected the termites. Now, this is a pretty gruesome process where you get a pair of tweezers and you grab the termite by the neck.
And in Southern California, an outbreak of measles raises concerns about unvaccinated kids. And a shout-out about Yelp. It's not a cry for help, unless you're one of the businesses being panned on this popular website.
And immediately I felt this sort of addictive element of sharing your opinion and letting other people react to that and respond to that.
I'm Juan Ha, in for Scott Schaefer. This is the California Report. It's budget season in Sacramento, and it's not looking pretty. The state is staring at a $16 billion budget gap this year. California's chief budget analyst, Elizabeth Hill, recently offered an alternative to the cuts Governor Schwarzenegger has laid out. That plan calls for raising $2.5 billion by rescinding tax breaks and loopholes. The governor yesterday said he supports the idea, even though he's long vowed not to raise taxes. A little doublespeak? Anthony York is editor of the Capital Weekly, which covers state politics and government. York says whether the plan is a turnaround for the governor depends on the semantics.
This is really a matter of political terminology. I mean, the legislative analyst wants to reduce the amount that Californians can write off on their taxes for having dependents. Elizabeth Hill proposes reducing that credit from about $300 to $100. So whether that's a loophole or a tax credit, it really is in the eye of the beholder. We've heard a lot about the yacht tax loophole. There's a provision in state law that allows yacht owners, when they buy a new yacht, to, if they dock their yacht somewhere outside of California for, I believe it's 6 months, and then return to California, then they don't have to pay certain taxes on the purchase of that yacht. That's one that has been identified by Democrats in the legislature as a loophole they would like to close, and that is one that the governor does support eliminating.
Is there an artful way that the governor could present this plan and still say he's sticking to his pledge of no new taxes?
In the world of capital political terminology, there's a difference between a tax and a fee. There's certainly some legal difference. A tax, you need two-thirds approval in the legislature to get a new tax approved, and a fee is a majority vote provision. You know, all sorts of agencies up and down the state, many regulatory agencies, are what are called fee-based agencies. They're funded by fees that are assessed on a certain industry, and the fees for that industry go into the cost of the enforcement and the regulation of that industry.
So, you know, Republican leaders are saying that there's no way they'll vote for this. Has the governor lost some credibility in the eyes of Republican leaders for even just entertaining the idea of eliminating tax breaks?
It's hard to imagine how the governor's standing in the eyes of legislative Republicans could get much lower. Remember, last summer we had a record-long standoff where we only had one Republican in the state Senate who would vote for the budget. Clearly, I think since 2006, since the reelection campaign began in 2006, the governor has done some things that have irked the Republican legislative leadership here in Sacramento. So that relationship is already contentious. Now, we do have a new leader of the Senate Republicans, Fresno's Dave Cogdill, who was selected this week to be the new leader. So, there's going to be a new speaker and a new leader in the state Senate, too. So there are going to be three new faces in the so-called Big Five negotiations over the budget this year. That's when the four legislative leaders and the governor sit down and try to hammer out a deal on the budget. But clearly there's some repairing of the image between the governor and the Republican Party that needs to be done.
Anthony York is editor of Capital Weekly. Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you.
At least a dozen children in San Diego County are infected with measles. The outbreak began last month after an unvaccinated child returned from a family trip to Europe with the virus. Childhood vaccines are hailed as one of the greatest public health achievements, but a growing number of parents just don't think they're safe. From KPBS in San Diego, Kenny Goldberg has the story.
6.5-year-old Miles Carlson and his little brother, Quentin, love to build things.
We're making a castle out of these big Legos, and this is the lookout spot.
The Carlson brothers sure look like typical kids, but they're different from most other children. They're largely unvaccinated. Their mom, Sybil, says Miles had all of the standard vaccinations until he was one. But then she started to read things on the internet that made her worry about vaccines.
And I just came to a point where I felt like I was more and more afraid. I was actually scared to have him vaccinated.
There are a number of stories on the internet claiming a link between the measles vaccine and autism. There's also information about supposed toxic chemicals in vaccines. After Quentin was born, Carlson and her husband decided to give him one meningitis vaccination, and that was it.
And after that, I just kept reading and just didn't feel comfortable. And every time I read new information, it just solidified my belief that I was making the right decision.
So Miles Carlson is only partially protected against diseases like diphtheria, polio, and measles. Quentin has virtually no protection at all. Sybil Carlson concedes her kids could be at risk, but she says it's a choice she had to make.
I feel like the chances of them contracting a disease and having a very serious reaction or dying from it are less than that happening from giving them all of the vaccines that are now recommended for children.
The vaccines are incredibly safe, but nothing is 100% safe.
Dr. Howard Backer heads up the immunization branch of the California Department of Public Health. He says some kids have adverse reactions to vaccines, but he says such reactions are infrequent.
They're very rare, and it depends on the vaccine.
In fact, the Centers for Disease Control says reactions occur so rarely that they're difficult to quantify. A variety of scientific studies show no link between childhood vaccines and autism. Backer says it's true the chances of a child getting a disease like the measles or polio are low. He says that's because most children have received all of their vaccinations. But for unvaccinated kids, potential danger is only a plane ride away. On January 15th, an unvaccinated 7-year-old flew back to San Diego from Switzerland with the measles. The child infected 2 siblings and 4 classmates at school. 4 other kids who went to the same clinic as the sick child also came down with measles. Health officials say hundreds more children may have been exposed. Dr. Mark Sawyer is a specialist in pediatric infectious diseases at UC San Diego. He says measles is one of the most contagious diseases known to man.
I'd like to remind people of the outbreak we had here in San Diego in 1989 and 90, where we had hundreds of cases and we had 3 deaths from the measles. And these are in healthy children. It isn't something that is uniquely a problem in children whose immune system is compromised. This affects everybody and can kill even healthy children.
All of the San Diego kids who are sick with measles were either unvaccinated or were under the minimum age to get inoculated. Measles kills about 250,000 children worldwide every year. Hepatitis B, another preventable condition, causes chronic liver disease. Dr. Backer says parents need to wake up.
If too many people choose not to be vaccinated, we will start seeing these diseases on a regular basis, and unfortunately we'll have to experience the dangerousness and seriousness of these diseases.
Sybil Carlson remains unconvinced. She's not saying all of the doctors and health officials are wrong, but
Their agenda is different. Their agenda is for general public health. And I'm not going to sacrifice my children in the interest of general public health.
California law requires all incoming kindergartners to be fully vaccinated against measles, diphtheria, and other diseases. But it allows parents to opt out for religious or personal beliefs. Statewide, more than 8,700 kindergartners are unvaccinated. For the California Report, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
Global warming and rising gas prices have just about everyone, including presidential candidates, touting biofuels. Turning plants into a gasoline alternative could be the next big thing. But there are a number of challenges. As Andrea Kissick reports, the Bay Area is at the forefront of unlocking this new technology.
Making fuel from plants isn't new. For centuries, people have been turning plant matter into alcohol. In fact, the basic recipe for moonshine? Grind up a plant, like corn, into sugar water, add yeast, and ferment. But alcohol can also run engines. That's basically what they are doing here in Emeryville at the new Joint Bioenergy Institute, or JBEI, a project of Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, UC Berkeley, and other research institutions.
If you think about a plant, it's really sugar that makes up a large fraction of the plant, maybe half of the plant material.
Jay Kiesling is a professor of chemical engineering at UC Berkeley. He heads up JBEI, which is funded by a $125 million grant from the Department of Energy.
What we're trying to do overall is break that plant cell wall back down into sugars and then take the sugars and turn them into fuels.
But breaking down the tough cell walls of plants isn't easy.
Cell walls have evolved to be strong, so that a plant stands sturdy, and so that it isn't degraded by all of the organisms that are attacking it in the environment.
Kiesling and his colleagues are trying to do three things. Find the plants, known as feedstocks, that produce energy most efficiently, like switchgrass and wood chips. Second, find ways to quickly and inexpensively break down the cell walls of those plants. Finally, they are looking at different kinds of microbes that will help convert those sugars into alcohol, which can be used as fuel. It may be one of the world's most important chemistry projects in the coming decade.
We originally start out with growth medium that contains the sugar that's very clear.
Kiesling is standing next to what looks like a small refrigerator with a glass door. Inside are flasks full of tiny microbes that are heated and shaken so they will grow as quickly as possible.
And you see, this is very cloudy, very dense, so these microbes have been growing for a few days, hopefully producing our product.
A product that Kiesling says will be better than corn ethanol, the biofuel of choice for the past three decades. Growing corn for fuel presents a number of problems. It competes with the food supply. It delivers lower mileage than gasoline, and you can't transport it through traditional pipelines. So trucks and trains carry corn ethanol, spewing pollution. Welcome to the labs of LS9, a biofuels company in San Carlos. This Silicon Valley startup began 2 years ago. The founders wanted to make the perfect biofuel, so they decided to make a type of synthetic petroleum.
Because it can plug directly into the existing infrastructure in terms of pipelines, in terms of refineries, in terms of vehicles on the road today.
Gregory Powell with LS9 says the company is using standard microbes such as E. coli and yeast to break down plant matter into a pure petroleum replacement. Powell says the cost of the product needs to be brought down so that it can be mass produced.
We feel like you need to be able to produce a product that is competitive with crude oil at about $45 to $50 a barrel. So we believe that we'll be able to get to those levels of production and we'll have our first commercial plant up and running within 3 years.
Several other California companies are working on turning plant matter into fuel, as well as converting algae and trash into biodiesel. But the answer to our fossil fuel crisis could come from someplace more extreme than Silicon Valley, like the jungles of Costa Rica, where Bay Area researchers prospecting for better microbes are looking at the digestive enzymes from termites.
Costa Rica is termite heaven. There are just literally, you know, tens, probably hundreds of species.
Phil Eugenholtz is a microbiologist at the Department of Energy's Joint Genome Institute in Walnut Creek.
We went to Costa Rica. We found a nest of termites. We then dissected the termites. Now, this is a pretty gruesome process where you get a pair of tweezers and you grab the termite by the neck.
We'll save you from the details of the autopsy. Basically, Eugenholtz and his colleagues removed the digestive tracts of about 200 of the wood-chewing pests. What they found is that termites make great bioconverters.
They can take wood and chew it down into small particles, which they then ends up in their stomachs. And in their stomachs, the microorganisms can take these small particles of wood, which are essentially just chains of sugars, and break them down into sugars.
Eugenholtz believes that natural process could hold the key to an endless source of alternative fuel. Researchers expect it will take about 5 years to develop a biofuel that costs as much as a gallon of gasoline. But there are questions about whether biofuels are the best solution. Two new studies out this month suggest that the process of clearing land for biofuel farming may generate more greenhouse gases than was previously thought. And we may not have enough arable land to grow crops that will feed the world's increasing appetite for fuel. For the California Report, I'm Andrea Kissick.
You can take a peek at Andrea Kissick's reporter notes. Just go to our website, californiareport.org. If you hear something that gets you thinking, tell us what's on your mind. Send your comments, questions, or story ideas to us at calreport@kqed.org. That's calreport@kqed.org. And whether you're in Eureka or Escondido, you don't need a radio to hear us. You can download the show as a podcast at californiareport.org/podcast. That's californiareport.org/podcast. Oh, if you're an iTunes user, you'll find us there too. ...2007 was a lucrative year for contemporary art. Sales at Auction House Sotheby's reached almost $1.5 billion. And one of California's largest museums, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, teamed up with a local billionaire whose collection is said to be one of the best in the country. But the arrangements between the museum and its patron are raising eyebrows. From KPCC in Los Angeles, Adolfo Guzman Lopez reports.
The museum's opening brought together civic, art leaders, and elected officials. L.A. County Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky said the museum's opening is a momentous occasion.
And if this was the only thing that we had achieved in the cultural arts in this decade, I think the city and county would have called it a decade, would have been a pretty good decade, to have the Broad Contemporary Art Museum at LACMA.
World-renowned architect Renzo Piano designed the building. He placed the museum's front door in the rear of the building, and entry is on the third floor, accessed by an open escalator with a postcard view of the Hollywood Hills. Once inside, the doors open, and a skylit gallery of contemporary art treasures beckons. Jesse Stanley just walked in.
It's awesome. I love Koons' work.
Stanley's talking about Jeff Koons' 10-foot-tall stainless steel sculpture of a Mylar balloon dog.
My wife, she wants me to get a picture of her by it. She thinks her pink dress and the blue, that shiny reflective blue, will look most excellent.
Shirley Monson's making her way through galleries, displaying a dozen works by Andy Warhol, 7 paintings by Robert Rauschenberg, and 12 paintings by Roy Lichtenstein. She's excited. Monson became a member of the L.A. County Museum of Art after she moved here from Michigan 25 years ago. Back then, friends from the East Coast warned her that L.A. had no culture.
They don't say that anymore. They might not like L.A., but they don't say that anymore.
The museum's benefactor, billionaire philanthropist Eli Broad, has had a large part in turning L.A.'s reputation around. He's turned the wealth from 2 Fortune 500 companies he founded, KB Home and Sun America, into a source of philanthropy. In the last 8 years, he's donated about $1.5 billion to charitable causes, making him one of the country's top benefactors. And, like wealthy men before him, he's amassed a large art collection. So big, he started a foundation about 25 years ago to conserve, warehouse, and lend out pieces. About 5 years ago, Broad told the L.A. County Museum of Art he'd pay to build a new contemporary art museum on the property to house his collection. Broad ended up giving $60 million. But last month, just weeks before the museum's opening, Broad shocked many when he announced he wouldn't be donating his collection to the L.A. County Museum of Art. His foundation, Broad says, is better equipped to house and lend the works for the museum. Arts administrators, Broad says, praise the unusual arrangement.
They've seen all too many collections given a museum with it ending up in the basement 80-90% of the time. And those people that have given those collections have been rather disappointed because they expected the work to be shown to a broad public, which hasn't happened.
Patrons don't seem to care who owns the artwork. More than 26,000 people walked through the museum's galleries on opening weekend. Arts journalist Tyler Green says ownership does matter because when a collection's in private hands, some of the public institutions' decision-making over how to show the art is taken away.
Collectors are not curators. And I think that what we're seeing is the question of what happens when one part of the system, collectors, has more control and influence than other parts, such as curators, critics, scholars, museum directors.
For now, L.A. County Museum officials are keeping the focus on the art, including plenty of masterworks. On the ground floor at the Broad Museum, Lael Rubin meanders through sequence by renowned sculptor Richard Serra. The work consists of 15-foot-high steel plates bent into soft curves. Sarah's created an elliptical path between hundreds of tons of weathered steel. Rubin skipped lunch at her downtown L.A. office to experience it firsthand.
It didn't seem like I was here in the museum, that I just was transported.
Other work in the Broad Contemporary Art Museum includes basketballs immersed in a water tank, a table and chairs four times the size of an adult, and an upside-down chair and a mannequin leg jutting out of a painting. It was all a bit much for Shirley, a retired Inglewood teacher who'd only offer her first name.
Some of it is weird. Some of it's very nice. It's good to see once. Like, I wouldn't want to come back over and over again to see it.
The L.A. County Museum of Art is counting on curiosity to attract lots of new visitors at least once. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
Where do you turn when you're looking for a reliable doctor, a wine bar, or a dry cleaner? You could just call up a friend, or you can Yelp. The website Yelp.com has been transforming the way millions of people find local services and creating its own unique community in the process. Reporter Stephanie Martin knows. She's been doing a little Yelping herself lately.
I didn't think I'd ever trust the opinions of total strangers for something as stressful and expensive as a big move across town. But last month, I needed movers, fast. I went to Yelp.com and, just like this, came up with a 5-star rated company called Golden Bay Relocation. Former customers described the crew as careful, kind, and considerate. And almost everyone raved about this guy named Fernando, who turns out to be Golden Bay's owner. In fact, one review literally sang Fernando's praises with the lyrics of a song by ABBA. Since there's nothing like a little 1970s Swedish pop music to spur me to action, I booked a move with Golden Bay, and they were careful, kind, and considerate. Score one for the Yelpers.
I am Jeremy Stoppelman, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Yelp.
I met up with Stoppelman at Yelp's small headquarters in downtown San Francisco to find out more about his company and the random people who, I admit, have been guiding more than a few of my decisions lately. It's a classic startup environment. T-shirted techies tapping away on their keyboards, a frisbee here, a hula hoop there, and there's a caramel-colored dog curled up on a cushion.
He's a Vizsla. His name is Darwin.
I asked Stoppelman about the origin of the Yelper species. He says it all started about 4 years ago when he and his good pal Russell Simmons were looking for ideas for a new website. During the brainstorming, Stoppelman came down with a nasty cold.
I'm like, you know what, I've had a few doctors and I wasn't quite happy with them.
He thought he could find patients' recommendations online.
And when I searched, I found nothing.
So Stoppelman and Simmons launched their first version of Yelp, a site designed to help groups of friends ask each other for specific recommendations for doctors, hairdressers, restaurants. But that's not the part that really caught on.
Buried in there, sort of as an afterthought, was this way to write your own reviews.
Unsolicited reviews, posted on the internet for anyone to look at and use. Stoppelman says he didn't really understand why it was so popular until he tried it himself.
And immediately I felt this sort of addictive element of sharing your opinion and letting other people react to that and respond to that.
I was very skeptical that Yelp would be able to succeed, but I was proven completely wrong.
That's tech industry analyst Greg Sterling, who's been watching Yelp's rapid spread to cities nationwide. He says when Yelp came on the scene, the market was already pretty crowded with review sites like CitySearch. But he says Yelp broke away from the pack by offering some things that were a little different.
You could actually see photos of the individuals writing the reviews. The reviews had a quality of being tied to an actual person rather than a first name or being anonymous.
Users share photos and talk with one another on message boards. And Sterling says, much like Google, Yelp has a catchy brand name.
The term has become sort of a verb.
When you go online to check out a review, you're Yelping. You're also Yelping if you write a review. And when you write a review, that, of course, makes you a Yelper. And when you're a Yelper, well, that can be a world in and of itself. I got invited to a party for so-called elite Yelpers. It's mostly a group of young professionals who keep the site ginning along by contributing a lot of content and personality.
My Yelp persona is me as a pirate. It's mostly pictures of me in a pirate costume from Halloween a few years ago.
On Yelp, Don Hoffman goes by the name Don H., pirate extraordinaire. Silly, yes, but Hoffman says Yelp does provide an outlet for a serious passion.
I'm a big foodie, and I love eating, and San Francisco's a great place to eat, and there's so many restaurants that, you know, sort of trying to work on your own, there's no way you'd be able to ever find sort of all the hidden little gems.
Hoffman's posted about 500 reviews, not unusual in this crowd. Stephanie Watanabe last checked in at 516. I asked her what keeps her posting so prolifically.
You know, for me, it's actually a really nice creative outlet. I enjoy writing. I've always enjoyed writing. And it's also just a great way to meet people. It's fun.
Of course, not everyone is amused with a site that allows anyone to be a critic and potentially hurt someone's business.
We had a couple of bad reviews that I thought they were unfair.
Steve Rangevin owns Ruse Cafe, a small chain of coffee shops in Oakland that actually have gotten mostly good reviews.
And if you really have a problem with our establishment, you have two choices. Either come and talk to me or just don't come in. You don't need to put out a bad word over the internet.
Rangevin recently launched a counterattack that's gained him some notoriety in the Yelposphere, a bumper sticker emblazoned with the words, "No Yelpers." And he's got another one in the works, one that finds yet another way to use Yelp as a verb.
Yeah, it's going to say, go Yelp yourself.
Coming soon to a cafe near you.
Coming soon to a cafe near you in Oakland.
Come to think of it, I've had a few Yelping letdowns myself, including the 4-star rated bistro that botched my friend's birthday dinner, and there are the Yelpers who keep just giving 1 star to one of my favorite cafes. And there was something missing from my move with Golden Bay. Yes, the famous Fernando all those Yelpers were so wild about, he was in Chile during my move, visiting his mother for a much-needed vacation. Okay, Fernando, I guess you can keep your 5-star rating. For the California Report, I'm Stephanie Martin.
And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. Syl Muller is the technical producer, with engineering help from Tom Krimkowski. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson, Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, and Leanne Lucetta. Victoria Malione is our producer. We had editing help from Pat Flynn. Ingrid Becker is a senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Juan Ha. Scott Schaefer returns next week. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California. The California Teachers Association, because every child deserves a chance to learn and no child succeeds alone. More information is available at cta.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.